Hello, Connection Cafe readers and listeners. Welcome to the next podcast interview in a series of conversations with Convio employees, partners, and friends. My name is Corey Podoretsky, and I'm a Senior Client Strategy Executive here at Convio. The goal of this series is to allow you to get to know some of us better, what makes us tick, and why we enjoy working at Convio and with all of our clients. I'm super excited to bring you this month's conversation with Vinay Bhagat, the Founder and Chief Strategy Officer of Convio. We start our conversation, like other interviews, with Vinay telling me a little about how he came to work at Convio, or in this case, found the company. So, Vinay, thanks for taking the time to talk with me today. I thought it would be a great interview to have just to get your perspective over the history of Convio and kind of where we are today. Normally, I ask people as their opening question sort of what their role is at Convio and what brought them to Convio. And for you, that's, I think, a very unique sort of answer or story, and one that we all in the organization are very familiar with, and that probably even, clients or other listeners have heard before. But if you could spend just a moment telling me a little about how you came to found Convio and your history.
Sure. Actually, I moved here to Austin, Texas in 1998 from Boston, and was working in a high-tech company and loved the community here in Austin. Liked high-tech, but wasn't particularly enamored with the company that I was working for culturally. It just didn't really jive with me. So I sort of made the decision that I wanted to try and do something entrepreneurially. This was 1998, and there was certainly a lot of energy around entrepreneurship. And I think I'd always wanted to be an entrepreneur from a young child. Growing up in the UK, Richard Branson was one of my idols. But I think I'd suppressed that actual act of entrepreneurship until the point that I felt kind of prepared and ready. It was actually the event of going to a pledge drive at our local PBS station with my wife, who's a film producer, and at the time was doing work for PBS, that the idea for Convio came to me. I was literally one of the people on the phone with an index card in front of me, answering people's calls, asking them whether they would like a gift with their contribution, asking them if they were a current member or not, handing the index card to the director of development, seeing him key it into his database and thinking, wow, there really has to be a better way of doing this. And, the question I asked the director of development the next day was, have you heard of the internet? I think it could change your lives a little bit, jokingly. So that was the inception of Convio, but I didn't know much about the nonprofit sector, candidly, at that point in time. This was very early in 1999, so I did some initial homework to try and understand the size and scope of the sector and realized it was a very meaningful portion of the U.S. economy, 8-10% of GDP, and that there were a few viable commercial organizations like Blackboard and Grizzard, for example, who'd built substantial businesses within the sector. And I was, aspiring to build a viable commercial business as well as to have impact. And so that was important to me. I quit my job and spent about 6 months just talking to nonprofits of all shapes and sizes, ranging from the CIO at the American Red Cross down to regional nonprofits, and reached a conclusion that it was an underserved market and there was a real opportunity to bring web-based technology to the market to help harness the full potential of the internet. I also saw a real challenge in the market associated with data silos between different business functions, between communications, fundraising, advocacy, and events, and also between systems like email and donations and e-commerce and advocacy and content management tools and back-end databases. And I sought to try and solve that challenge of silos by bringing to market an integrated platform or solution for online marketing. I chose to not pursue the donor database category at that point in time because I viewed that category to be fairly well served and mature, and chose instead as a small company to focus on what I saw as the white space opportunity, which was the web. I got the company funded by raising venture capital in November of 1999. We raised $4.5 million to get the business off the ground. And the challenge at that point in time was then recruiting. I was not from Austin, so I didn't have a network. I'm actually from the UK. I'd only been in the US a couple of years at business school at that point. My co-founder was Scottish, and he didn't have a network either. And so we had to get very creative at recruiting people, flying planes over other high-tech company happy hours, hiring opera singers to sing arias about Convio at high-tech happy hours, and just really, really getting creative. One of the most creative tactics that we used was to advertise in our local newspaper with a picture of an old lady, a grandmother, who said, you know, your grandmother would be proud of you if you came to work at Convia. And I thought, okay, let's give it a shot. Let's see what happens. But lo and behold, we managed to recruit a really key person, Dave Harp, our head of engineering, now CTO, through that ad. And Dave is a hiring magnet, the kind of guy who could bring people with him. And within a week, we had 10 other engineers follow him. And so that was really a monumental moment for the company when we were all able to sort of finally have an engineering team, because it had been proven very hard going for a while. So after getting a team together, you know, the next big challenge was, can we actually go and make a market? And I found sort of a willing reception to take meetings, but, you know, the nonprofit market was new to the internet at that point in time. And, you know, I was new to the market, so I had to navigate and find out where we would find our best client base. And initially, we sold to Texas-based nonprofits, but ultimately started to see that there was a big need amongst national nonprofits on the East Coast. And I'm grateful to the early adopters who took a bet on us, a young company with what's now, you know, it was a very immature product at the time, but they took a bet and it paid off for them and it paid off for us. And it's really a great story. I remained at the helm as CEO of Convia for the first 4 years. And when we were about sort of 60, 70 people, decided that it was time to bring in sort of professional help from the outside. And we brought in Gene Austin as our CEO. And I transitioned to the role of Chief Strategy Officer, which is the role I still hold today. In that role, I've played a variety of roles. One very important one has been one of thought leadership and research, where each year we take on a major topic of research and we try and sort of conduct either primary donor research or a survey of organizations in the sector to try and understand an issue better. You know, in recent years, that's included things like the wide wealthy understanding mid-level and major donors online, the next generation of American giving when we wanted to understand demographic differences. And most recently, in the last couple of years, my focus has been on the theme of integrated marketing. My role as Chief Strategy Officer also has me interacting with clients a lot, either in sales or in terms of being an executive sponsor on certain relationships. And I've really enjoyed that direct customer contact. A year or so ago, I had the chance to serve on the Digital Advisory Committee of St. Jude's Children's Hospital. And for me personally, that was a wonderful experience to be able to help an organization in that way. Beyond that, I've also led our corporate development efforts here at the company, helping us decide, do we go into international markets like the UK, and then doing actual mergers and acquisitions of companies like Strategic One and Bagent in the UK to help us grow our business. And the other area that I've had time and enjoyed working with is just in the whole area of kind of product and service strategy, determining what should Convia actually do in those two areas. And one of the key projects that I worked on a few years ago was the move that we made to actually enter the donor management or CRM category, where we decided it was time and that there was a need that we could serve in the marketplace. And the market was over time going to appreciate cloud-based donor management, CRM solutions, and value the integration between CRM and online marketing.
And that kind of brings us up to present day. One of the things that I think I question and that I've always been impressed with working with you is your ability to be able to see the things that are important and kind of figure out priority and the direction that things are going. Can you share a little about your thought process and your methodology there?
Yeah. So there's a term floating around in the commercial world today called big data analytics. And in many ways, I kind of view my process as sort of a miniaturized version of that, where I try and aggregate as many inputs as I can, data sources. So I'm highly consumptive of information on the web. I subscribe to tens of different kind of email threads, listservs, content gets pushed to me. I do a lot of kind of just web searching myself. I do a lot of meetings with customers and with internal staff, and those all provide data inputs to form an opinion. And then I think a skill that I've mastered over the years and maybe is sort of, you know, just something that naturally comes to me, sort of given my background in sort of mathematics and engineering, is the ability to take large sets of data and synthesize them to their essence, to their core. You know, I think partly it's a desire to be succinct in how I communicate, that as an executive at a company, it's incumbent upon us to try and synthesize a complex topic into a set of key facts and priorities for people to follow. But also my role as an evangelist and as a communicator in the marketplace has been very important for me to be able to distill an issue to its essence and help people focus. You know, in the nonprofit sector, we've seen a lot of change in the last 10 to 12 years, and frankly, a lot of new shiny objects have come along. You know, everything from affiliate shopping, where people could yield commission from redirecting traffic to Amazon and to other retailers, to, you know, text to give, to mobile websites, to social media, etc. And some of those have become very important phenomenon, but others haven't. And I think part of my role has been to help provide guidance to our clients and to the marketplace as to what's relevant, you know, where should we focus. And again, I don't profess to have all original insights. I think a large part of my role is to observe and to listen and to see what others are doing, and then to try and collate that data from multiple sources and try and synthesize it into its essence. I'm also a big believer in primary research. And so in collaboration with Edge Research, an audience research firm, we've done primary research studies where in some cases we think it's important to get to the ultimate source, which is the constituent. And so probably my most fun project that I've done in the last few years has been the Next Generation of American Giving, where we moved beyond just surveying nonprofits as to their strategies and actually talk to the donor to really understand what's going on in their heads. That and the Wide Wealthy were both projects where we did that exercise, and I think they were the most insightful projects for me. But again, consume lots of data, but also believe it's incumbent upon me to be able to synthesize that data for my audience.
I guess when you think back of what has inspired you or what you've learned the most from, you mentioned some of the research projects being a lot of fun, but can you name any stories where, you know, somebody has really inspired or motivated or taught you lessons over the years? I'm sure that you have many, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been many inspirational moments. I'm proud of the work that many of our clients have accomplished, you know, in response to natural disasters. Frankly, when we worked with the Howard Dean campaign back in 2003, that was a pivotal point for the company where it really tested our systems at the time, but also pushed our thinking intellectually about how fundraising and constituent engagement was evolving. We've certainly have many cutting-edge clients over the years who've pushed us in different areas, and that's been interesting to understand their thinking and whether we could serve them and how the market was adapting. Frankly, individual donor stories are probably the most moving things. Again, when I served on the board or the DAC at St. Jude, I got to tour their facility and I got to hear from children and families firsthand about what they were going through. It's when you hear those stories, it's the most impactful to you and really helps you realize that what you're working on, you know, there's a greater good beyond what you do day to day that gets impacted. Relatively recently, an email was forwarded to me about someone who was using our new Common Ground Social Fundraising Tool, which is a simple peer-to-peer fundraising tool designed for small nonprofits using Common Ground as a CRM. And it was a story of a little boy who had real success using this tool. And again, those types of stories where individual lives are getting impacted on some small level through our technology is what really, really motivates me. And I think many of the people here at Convia. I mean, yes, we're here to build a successful business and grow a successful company, but it's those individual stories that ultimately just, you know, really light my fire.
Thinking back, what have been maybe some of the bigger surprises that you've had from the direction that you thought the market would go or that our business would grow, that it actually turned out to develop in another direction?
I'm not sure I had major surprises, because I think I didn't have a completely like ironclad view as to where the market would be. We had an initial direction, which was we believed that there was value in an integrated online marketing suite and that we would integrate to back office systems. And we had to do that just because of sheer focus. We couldn't tackle too big a problem day one. I think we always expected that there would be a desire for tighter integration between online and offline systems. And I think we've actually been active in driving that interest and driving that adaptation. But it didn't take me by surprise that the market would start to want these integrated systems. You know, we just had to be methodical about what we could do first, given the sort of scale and scope of the company. You know, I think if anything surprised me, this may come across the wrong way, but I've sometimes felt a bit frustrated by how slow things are to change. Mm. I'm a change agent at heart, and you know, that's sort of the DNA of being an entrepreneur. I'm often pushing for change at a higher pace than the market or others want to accommodate. Mm-hmm. And so I've had to actually probably be a little bit more patient than I'm naturally wired to be in terms of driving that adaptation and that change. I'll give you a specific example. In recent years, I've been an advocate really since 2007 that the world needed to head towards more integrated marketing strategy. And I think we're there now, but we're still fairly early on that journey. But I felt like I had to do a fair amount of evangelism, and others too, to really kind of drive this thinking and change. To take another kind of even more meaningful point, it was intuitively obvious to me in 2000 that the internet was going to transform how nonprofits engage their constituents. But it took about 5 or 6 years to convince the market universally that that was going to be the case. And probably there still are some laggards out there who are still not convinced mm-hmm. that the internet is strategic to them. They need a resource for it properly, and they need to invest properly in it. And so I guess a challenge that I've personally faced is just how do you convince the market of something that you see? Clearly, it's going to happen, but maybe not all of the evidentiary proof points are in effect yet, but there's sort of parallels that you can see in other markets like the commercial sector that give you a very strong sense of where the market is ultimately headed. And again, my two big examples of that were the strategic role of the internet being more widely embraced across a wider group of kind of verticals and sizes of nonprofits. And secondly, just the importance of now integrated marketing and more of a kind of CRM methodology for engaging constituents.
Do you venture to make any predictions beyond the goal of integrated marketing and the constituent engagement? What's the next trends then after that that you think we can look forward to?
Yeah, I mean, I still think, you know, if we listen to donors, there are a few key kind of telling trends. One is younger generations are much more apt to respond to solicitations from peers than they are directly from a brand. And I think that applies to both philanthropy and to consumer product purchases, where social commerce, the notion of responding to what your friends do, or frankly, just other consumers do, is a really huge phenomenon. And it hasn't fully taken hold yet in the nonprofit sector. We clearly see in the special events arena that peer-to-peer online marketing is a really big deal. And it's taken hold there in a meaningful way. But outside of special events, organized signature special events, the market is still pretty nascent here in the US. I think there are some lessons from the UK in terms of how to capitalize on third-party events like marathons and things that are occurring and community events that are occurring. Beyond that, few charities have really systematized a way to do peer-to-peer outreach outside of organized charity events. One charity that I admire greatly in terms of their marketing strategies is Charity Water. Mm-hmm. They're a new charity. They were born in the last decade. Therefore, they've been able to do a lot of things differently. And they've been one of the pioneers in sort of social fundraising in a non-event context. Mm-hmm. But more broadly, I don't see a lot of charities doing that.
Yeah, I really loved their, was it Give It Forward campaign?
The Water Forward, Pay It Forward campaign, yeah. And, you know, it's raised a few $100,000, so it's, you know, maybe a relatively small campaign in the big picture of philanthropy, but it's an indication of where things are headed. And I think strategic organizations need to embrace that phenomenon. Vis-a-vis integrated marketing, we're still very early on the journey. You know, we talk about sort of different phases, siloed, sort of semi-integrated, where we maybe are integrating message themes across channels, we're maybe trying to synchronize emails and direct mail. But where we're not yet is in the optimized phase, where we really think about what the individual donor wants and how do we optimize our communications, both in terms of channel frequency and content, to optimize engagement and to optimize net profit from that individual. What I mean by that is you may have someone who is responsive in both channels, but if you can drive them more online, you can improve your net revenue out of the individual. And so there's clearly a demographic overlay to the strategy. There also needs to be more of a notion of creating a supported journey or a pathway that we're trying to lead people down, and then using data to kind of optimize that pathway in time. And so another big trend that I see needing to occur in the sector is just the more strategic use of data and analytics. This is a massive trend in the corporate world today. If you read interviews with the CIO of Procter & Gamble, for example, you know, obviously a huge consumer marketing company, he is outsourcing all technology related to operations. And instead, he wants to build a team of business analysts who focus on consuming data and making sense of it. In the retail world, we see online and catalog retailers like Coldwater Creek with a 100-person business analytics team, which is obviously massive. The notion of business analytics is still incredibly nascent in the nonprofit marketplace. And what it really means is aggregating all relevant data into one repository that may or may not be your donor database, depending on your scale, and then layering on reporting and analytic capabilities that make that data useful for different users in your organization. At a basic level, it's making that data useful for kind of the key strategists at your organization who are architecting your marketing strategies and your constituent development strategies. But in the context of national organizations with chapters and regional events, it's also finding consumable ways to disseminate that data such that field offices can make use of that intelligence as well. And in the commercial world, one of the new hot companies in that space is a business called Click that is all about making data accessible on mobile devices like iPads. And I really think that's the future. It's aggregating data, making that data insightful and clickable and visual, and then disseminating that data to the relevant stakeholders inside an organization. Mm-hmm. And it will start with the big nonprofits first, but often we find innovations occurring in mid-sized and small charities as well who, you know, just kind of get it and move ahead of their larger peers because they can be more nimble.
That was actually going to be my follow-up question as you were speaking was, so smaller organizations might say, well, that's great for Procter & Gamble, but how do I do that? And it sounds like there, you think there might be some opportunities, regardless of scale, to be able to leverage some of that data.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't fully thought through this yet in terms of kind of data analytics, but in terms of just strategically using technology, some of our most innovative clients who embrace the notion of CRM and using fully cloud-based solutions, moving towards being a more digital organization, are small organizations. One of the recent winners of our annual Innovator Awards is a small organization in Washington, D.C. called the Project on Government Oversight. They've done some really cutting-edge stuff. Mm-hmm. They've also embraced mobile in terms of their web presence. Another charity here in Austin, Texas that we speak about a lot is Mobile Loaves and Fishes, who actively thinks about integrated marketing. They've done some really compelling risk-taking campaigns where they've even done something like put a homeless person in the billboard and then encourage somebody to text to donate as a result. So I think there are, you know, oftentimes innovative small charities that we can all learn from. Charity Water, you know, started from scratch in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Now I believe they're around $25 million in annual revenue, but they have a two-person digital team. They've achieved a lot with a very small set of resources.
Mm-hmm. What do you like to do personally, or what's just sort of some other things that you're interested in?
Well, the most important things in my life right now are my son and daughter. I have a 3-year-old boy and a 2-year-old girl, Kashan and Yasmin. They are the joy of my lives. I love to just play with them and spend time with them. My 2-year-old girl's favorite word right now is bouncy castle because she loves me to take her. Well, my kids both love going to these sort of soft play bouncy castle places, and I'm one of those parents that crawls through the tunnels with their kids. You know, it's my workout at the weekend, and I just love being with them, and I'm very family oriented, and that's what really moves me. Beyond that, I'm a swimmer, and when I find time, I try to swim regularly. It's a way of trying to keep some of the pounds off from, you know, when I travel and eat, you know, pizza on the road. It's a way of trying to ameliorate that. But again, at this phase of my life, my children are my most important thing to me, and you know, my wife and I are really, really very invested in them. Mm-hmm. We do get involved philanthropically with causes, mostly local causes. My wife is frankly more active than I am, just given time. So she serves on the boards of several national and local causes that are of passion to her. She's very involved in the art scene. She's Indian, but she's very involved in the Latino community because she used to report for a Latino public radio station, or a program, I should say. And so she's involved in a group called Futura Media out of New York. She's involved with a social entrepreneurship competition here in Austin that Dell funds. And so she's pretty active in that, and I try to sort of help out when I can with some of the thinking for those organizations. And then, you know, philanthropically, we've supported a couple of groups here in town. We support our local public radio station, our members of the leadership circle there, mm-hmm. but also support a group in Austin called the Miracle Foundation that funds orphanages in India. So it's sort of it melds our passion for children, given that we have young kids ourselves, with my origins being Indian and wanting to sort of do something for my homeland.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You talked a little about your thought approach in terms of developing, you know, strategy and just thinking through problems, but what about your working style in general? Do you listen to music when you're not in meetings or on the phone, or how do you prefer to work?
I probably have ADHD. I don't know. I've never been diagnosed, but I tend to kind of multitask. This is probably not good work efficiency, but I check my email every few seconds, mm-hmm. you know, because it constantly pings. So I'm pretty responsive to email. I tend to have several documents open at a time. If I'm on a phone call, I'm probably doing something else at the same time as well. And I strive to kind of make sure I'm concentrating, but I'm often multitasking. A fair amount of my work actually gets done at home, where I get up early in the morning with my kids and spend some time with them. But while they're sort of settling down, having breakfast, I'll be on email, editing documents, doing things. After I go home, I spend a few hours, put them to bed, and then we'll usually get online again. Just because, again, there's a finite amount of stuff I have to get done each day, but to me, spending those quality hours with them when they need me is really, really important. And therefore, trying to juxtapose and juggle when I get my work done is important. Sometimes that does mean I've been on conference calls and there's been a crying toddler in the background, which I try and avoid. But, you know, sometimes it can't be helped.
I've gotten a dial from your son, I think, before on your phone. So I know. And as you know, being a, you know, a one-year-old dad myself, I feel the same way. The time that I have between when I get home and when my daughter goes to sleep is just so valuable.
It's precious, yeah. And we can't have this again. I went to Harvard Business School, and one of my friends from school said, who's also very family-oriented, said he'd spoke to one of his mentors, a professor, who expressed that a lot of successful business people often, you know, really focus on their career to the point that they miss out on their kids' early years. And then, you know, they try and engage later, but at that point, they can never reclaim those earlier years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the growth that the kids go through in their first few years and the need for their parents and the joy that you feel as a parent by spending time with them in these early formative years is not anything you can trade off. You know, it's just, again, to me personally at least, this is the most precious thing in my life right now, and I wouldn't trade it off for anything.
I guess the other thing I ask most Cameo employees is, rather than ask like a day in the life, I ask what's the very next thing you're going to do after we get out of this interview. I think sometimes that can be illustrative in terms of, you know, priorities or work and roles. If you were to open up your calendar and think about the next thing you were going to do, what would be that next thing?
Well, I would check my email and see what additional things have come up. Mm-hmm. Review my to-do list. So I do, one of the things I do to try and organize myself is I run a daily to-do list, mm-hmm. and try and be task-oriented. And so I'd literally just kind of go down my to-do list and try and check off things. Mm. Currently, I'm working on our annual benchmark report with our consulting team. And so I had a call with them this morning. I'm sort of just in the process of editing that document with them, so that's probably what I'll jump into next.
And my typical last question is, finish this sentence. Life is full of
opportunities, and it's up to us what we do with them. There's an expression, seize the day, and I really kind of believe in that. I don't believe in letting life happen to you. I believe in grabbing the bull by the horns and really trying to make the most of life, be that with family, be that professionally, be that taking a risk to do something. To quote another sort of phrase or cliche, nothing ventured, nothing gained, mm-hmm. right? You have to take risks to succeed in life. And the concept of risk is obviously not alien to entrepreneurship. My belief about entrepreneurs is that they are not natural risk takers per se, in the sense of, say, a gambler.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I love risk. I believe you have to take risks, but they have to be calculated risks to succeed. If you don't take risks as an entrepreneur or as an organization or as an individual with your career, with your marketing program, if you don't test and you don't take some calculated risks, you're not going to drive disruptive improvement. You're going to drive kind of minor incrementalism. You know, for some industries, minor incrementalism is okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not attracted to minor incrementalism. I'm interested in driving disruptive change. And I like to feel like, you know, we've done that. We didn't invent online fundraising. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't claim to be the Al Gore of online fundraising. But, you know, I feel like we had an impact in making it a reality. And we're trying to do the same thing now with multi-channel and the strategic adoption of new media opportunities like mobile and social into the marketing mix, and the adoption of new methodologies around donor treatment strategies. And the organizations who are going to get ahead are the ones that do take calculated risks. They innovate. You know, they're entrepreneurial. They're willing to fail. But you just need to be smart about the risks that you take and measured, so that you're minimizing your downside and you're quick to correct things that don't work, and you're quick to capitalize on things that do work.
And that wrapped up the conversation that Vinay and I had. It was personally an honor and a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to sit down and talk with Vinay in this format. I'm sure, like others at Convio and across the nonprofit sector, Vinay has inspired me to think creatively about the future of nonprofits, constituent engagement, integrated fundraising, marketing, and advocacy. I've been grateful for his insight and leadership over the years. If you have any follow-up questions or comments, please post them in the comments section of the Connection Cafe. And so until the next podcast interview, thanks for listening and keep up the great work.